Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers. Additional KCRW programs and podcasts are available at kcrw.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, director Tim Burton, had quite a year last year. Two big hits with Johnny Depp, the live-action Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and, of course, the stop-motion animated Corpse Bride, which is nominated for an animation Oscar. Tim, thanks for being here.
Nice to see you.
Tell me about what attracts you to stop-motion. I think it's fascinating. The year, in an era of all computer animation, you basically still prefer that, don't you?
Well, it's nice. I mean, you know, a lot of it stems, I think I might have said before, growing up watching Ray Harryhausen and loving his films. And you know, even before you knew anything about it, you could see the sort of handmade artistry that went into it. And I think there's something about that medium. It's like Pinocchio or something is bringing this inanimate object to life that's just really beautiful. And I don't know, you just feel the handmade quality to it. It was just something I love.
There's something really dreamy about it too, the way you do it, isn't there?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think, again, it's because it's such an old-fashioned technique. I mean, it's really, you know, it's the kind of the history of cinema, you know, frame by frame. So it really does tap into that primal kind of cinema experience too for me, which I think gives it part of its magic. And you know, when you couple that with like a kind of a fairy tale, it just seems like the project and the medium worked well together.
You can do me a favor just for people, since now it's on DVD, if you could describe what Corpse Bride is about a little bit.
Well, it's sort of about growing up in Burbank, California, indirectly.
There's
the juxtaposition of, you know, real life being much representing the sort of the repressed side of life. I mean, it's less about life and death than it is just about life, in the sense that the Land of the Living sort of represented that sort of bureaucratic sort of aspects that you go through in life, where the Land of the Dead sort of was much more representative of the sort of creative side of your life. So, again, it's not meant to be literally about life and death, but the two sides of life, really.
And but it's funny that you're talking about this, because so many of your movies are about that side of life, sort of, or at least the dream side versus kind of landlocked reality, aren't they?
Well, that's because I think people struggle with that every day. You know, no matter what your job is, I think it does seem like it's, at least for me and everybody I know, it's kind of the classic, you know, two sides of life that you have to go through. It's the right side of your brain, the left side of your brain, you know, the fantasy side of life, the bureaucratic side of life. I mean, you're always sort of, you know, butting up against those things all day, every day. So it seems to be something I think about a lot.
It's also, too, fighting, as you mentioned here, but that happens in a lot of your films as well, sort of fighting that side of you that's repressed in some way, the id versus the superego, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing. You can't really escape your upbringing. And, you know, for me, part of my release was, you know, I was not a very demonstrative person. So, you know, you would release it by doing drawings or doing films, so that, you know, everybody needs an outlet, whether it's music or writing or anything that kind of lets you let off, you know, some emotional or creative steam is very valid for, I think, everybody.
It's The Treatment. My guest is director Tim Burton. We're talking about his big successes of last year, of course, Corpse Bride and Charlie and Chocolate Factory. But that brings me to a point that fascinates me about you, too, is that you often go back and forth between something like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is something a lot of us know and have our own feelings about, to originals like Corpse Bride. And I wonder what that represents for you, moving back and forth in those two worlds the way that you often do.
Well, and this was literally back and forth, because, I mean, they were happening at the same time.
Were they?
So, yeah, I mean, it got a little schizophrenic, because, like, we'd be shooting Charlie, like, in the day, and then go over with Johnny and do, like, Corpse Bride recording sessions right after that. And so it was kind of schizophrenic, but, you know, I was lucky because with him doing both, and, you know, I used a couple of the actors who were working on Charlie and did voices for Corpse Bride, just because, you know, it sort of made it convenient to be kind of doing it at the same time. But I don't know if I'd ever do that again. But both are different things. I love Charlie, I grew up reading that book and loved the material a lot. And then, you know, Corpse Bride is just special, more personal project. So it's great to do both at the same time, actually.
But it definitely begs the question that it's almost like you somehow see these movies as a kid and you think, how would I do that? I mean, that must have occurred to you or reading that book or those things.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm of, you know, the television generation. So, you know, I unfortunately, like others, you know, read a great novel and want to make it into a movie. You know, I'll see a bubblegum card that I used to like and want to make it a movie. You know, I mean, so it's not on the same sort of artistically noble plane. But, you know, everybody's somewhat of a product of what, you know, the inspirations that you had growing up. So whether it's a book or a TV show I remember thinking things like the Beverly Hillbillies was high art, you know, growing up in certain things. And so it's just whatever your background is, I think, is part of what is your inspiration as you go on.
But just that divided world you're talking about, that dichotomy, that really is so much key to what you do. And I wonder when it first started to materialize for you as a creator.
Well, I was lucky to go through, you know, not really film school proper, but animation school, which was, I thought it was a good upbringing because, you know, you had to sort of draw everything, design everything, and
you can do it for when you start out in the Disney factory, which is
yeah,
a very specific
absolutely.
Kind of design.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, luckily I couldn't do that. I was terrible at that style, so they let me kind of go do my own thing, which was quite lucky because, you know, I had real, and I do admire people that are able to, you know, that was one thing about doing that Disney style of animation. You had to be kind of both a factory worker in some level and then like an artist, and to kind of get those two sides of your brain working together takes a real kind of special person. You know, I wasn't really that type of person.
But it must have been great for you because you came in at the era where a lot of the great old men of the animation stages of Disney were still there.
Yeah, they were all teachers at CalArts. I mean, like the first couple of years at CalArts, I mean, you know, a lot of the old great layout people, the people that designed some beautiful shots and all those old Disney cartoons were teachers out there. So it was a kind of a special time. And then at Disney, too, some were still there as well. I mean, just at the very tail end of that. But, I mean, you know, you look at credits like Snow White, you see the people that ended up being your teachers later on is quite an amazing thing.
What did you learn from those guys in terms of just bringing your own perspective to animation?
Well, I think they were all so different. I mean, that's the thing. There was a good mix of people. I mean, some were really great, just real good illustrators and draftsmen and designers. And so you just got their – what I got from is just their passion. You know, I mean, these guys, even after all those many years, you could still sense their passion in things. And, you know, that was just very nice to see, you know, because you're always reminded that it's a business. But then when you feel people's artistry and passion, it's – that's the reason you want to do it.
It's amazing to me, too, because I guess you worked on Fox and the Hound, right?
Yeah, for a while, yes.
For a while?
Yeah. Yeah, it was bad. I mean, that's where I really – I think if it hadn't been a four-legged animal – cute four-legged animals, I might have had a better time of it. But, you know, I had real trouble drawing the foxes. And I was working with a great animator, this guy Glenn Keane, who sort of took me under his wing and – He was a great draftsman, and he tried to help me along, but I really was terrible at it. But like I said, I was lucky because it gave me the opportunity to then just kind of do more what I wanted to do. Because I didn't do that well, they just sort of said, "Well, why don't you just try to do some designs for Black Cauldron and other projects?" And so I just got to design things for a couple of years.
It's true. We're talking to director Tim Burton. I guess I think about that. One of the things that I think it seems like you get from animation is that kind of forced perspective that's a real part of animation. Even your live action stuff, some of the shots have that kind of that point of view, don't they?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the great thing about having that animation background. It's like you think about, you know, the color and the sets. I mean, people often say with my work, oh, it just looks good, which always kind of upsets me a little bit because I don't think of things just as looking good. I don't even know what looks good, really. But I mean, I loved movies, grew up movies as being visual things. So that's the aspect of it or the part of it that that I do like in films that I've always enjoyed watching. So I always try to treat it, you know, color, perspective, sets as another character.
But that perspective, that point of view is a real directorial thing that I really associate with animation, that yeah. when people try to do that kind of thing, when they try to do animation nowadays even, yeah. it's missing. There's a kind of a flatness, a two-dimensional quality to
it. Well, it's interesting because, again, I think it really goes back to when you have to draw everything. You know, like when you have to do your little piece of animation when we had at CalArts, we have to do basically a little film. So, you know, you're kind of doing everything. You're acting it, you're drawing the sets, you're making it sort of live in that set dimensionally. So, I mean, it's kind of the ultimate sort of film background, kind of that type of schooling, which I wasn't really aware of it at the time, but now in retrospect and looking at it, you know, it was a good background.
Because it actually tells you where the camera's going to be as you're drawing the stuff and laying it out,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you really do think of it from that, just the nucleus, just right there from the center. And that's why, you know, that's why it's so much fun to also be able to build sets and do, I don't know, I just, it's all part of why you like making things is, you know, when you see a great set painter, you know, paint a beautiful sky. I mean, it kind of makes everybody, you, the actors, everybody just raises the energy up.
Because I'm guessing from doing all this stuff, you didn't have that problem that a lot of first-time directors have who they don't know where they put the camera. You probably knew exactly where you wanted the camera to be the first time you started to shoot, didn't you?
Well, yeah. And, I mean, I used to storyboard a lot. We don't storyboard as much just because I kind of actually – I think once you start working with actors and you start working with, like, really good improv kind of style actors, it kind of opens your mind up a lot to kind of – not necessarily relying so heavily on storyboards and just kind of feeling the energy of working with actors and kind of blocking it as you know, because it's not until you get there and you see, you know, the actors and the actual space and dimensions of things you're working with, can you really tell exactly what you want to do. So I kind of enjoy that process more.
But that must be part of the fun of building sets too, because the sets you build, the sets the actors are living on or working on, are at such odd perspectives anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it was when we built the chocolate waterfall on the James Bond stage, and you know, we filled up the stage with this like chocolate waterfall. And I remember like certain people, like visitors to Pinewood, kind of poking their head and going, like, "What kind of a James Bond movie is this?" You know, it's like, what's it? It looks like a large miniature golf course. It's like, but it was fun to kind of be able to build sets. Again, I think not only do I enjoy it, but I think especially with certain fantasy things, with the actors, you know, it helps. It just helps the whole environment, especially and also working with kids, I think. It's an extra added thing where you wanted to make it as real as possible and give people as much to deal with. And I think it's the same thing on Corpse Bride. There's something that's quite magical, you know, for as hard it is for the animators to be sitting in a dark room for 14 hours, the idea of seeing them actually tangibly being able to move something, there's just something really strong about that.
Does that help your improvisational sense too, just being in the room with the animators and thinking, well, I want to change this a little bit?
No, well, that it's different. I mean, that you just have to really rely on the animators. And I mean, they're really incredible people, the people that do this. In my mind, it's really specialized. So, no, I think, you know, you storyboard it, you do the animatic, you do all of that. But at the end, when it comes down to the shot, you know, really, it's the animators really acting it out. And that's true. There's not much you can really do with that except just lay it out and it's really up to them to give it the life.
We'll take a break and come back. My guest is Tim Burton. He's one of the directors of the Oscar-nominated Corpse Bride. Of course, his other film from last year was Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's The Treatment. Shake it, don't
break it. You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. I'm Elvis Mitchell in New York with Tim Burton. We're talking about, well, at least two of his films from last year, but a few of the others too, Corpse Bride, of course, and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. As you mentioned James Bond, one of the things I always think about your movies is that in a conventional sort of narrative sense, we're never exactly sure who the villain is.
Well, that kind of, again, stems from real life. I mean, you know, when people – I just remember growing up and people using the word normal so much. And you know, the word started to lose its meaning because what people said is normal seemed completely abnormal. So they're always and you know, you hear certain politicians and government give speeches and they say one thing, but there's always another side to it. And so I've always had trouble understanding what normal was. And also, you know, growing up watching monster movies where the villains were what were perceived as the villains were the most emotional characters
in
the piece.
And the most sympathetic characters.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and you know, you always felt for Frankenstein, and the angry villagers were the scary ones, you know, and that sort of is kind of true in society in a way. So I just always had a sort of a flipped, different perspective on. And also, you go back and as a child, you watch all those Disney movies, and the villains were always the best characters. So you sort of put all that together and you realize it's you know, the way people perceive things isn't the way they are necessarily.
It's because people develop these real emotional attachments to those figures who were supposedly villains, even the Creature from the Black Lagoon,
yeah.
all those guys.
Now, the actors were the scary ones because they were always like pretty bad and stiff, you know, and it was like and it's the same thing with Ray Harryhausen films. I mean, all of his creatures were incredibly emotional. I mean, you know, 20 million miles to Earth, you know, the creature from Venus or wherever, out of the little egg that grew up and then, you know, meets his end at the Colosseum in Rome. You know, I mean, they're all quite emotional characters that you feel for. And when you're, you know, doing that with something that's made out of wire and latex versus an actor, and the actors are faring much worse than that, you know, I mean, it's quite interesting.
Well, I guess that jerky sort of quality of the Harryhausen things must have had like a – you must have a special affection for that too.
Well, yeah. You know, something about the way he – even when a character wasn't meant to be an emotional character, he always had the great death scene, you know, the final little flick of the tail and, you know, the breathing. You'd hear the breathing and then it would stop. And, you know, he was always able to give those things an emotional quality that was – you know, you didn't see in live actors. I don't know.
It's the treatment. We're talking to director Tim Burton. What we're talking about, we look at this year, which is a year in this era of computer animation, all through the nominees are all not only sort of hand-created pieces, but they come from very specific points of view again. And I wonder if you think that as well is something that tends to be missing from a lot of computer stuff. You're looking at Miyazaki and the stuff that comes out of Aardman for Wallace and Gromit. Those are all things that are very much specific kinds of worlds.
It's great. I mean, it makes me really happy that that's the case. Again, I think what happens with computers is that people are – they look at Pixar's success, so that's why I think there's a sameness about it, is that they're just trying to do what they do and you know, and match that success, as opposed to kind of just taking a story, yeah, well, it seems to be best in this technique, or you know, it would be better if this were drawn, or this were stop motion, or this were computer. I think, you know, the projects that really think about that and make whatever, you know, if you're doing it computer, you know, I mean, like The Incredibles or something. That to me is perfect in that medium because it works with that medium, and it's a good combination of the two things. But you know, I think other people do things just for reasons of, you know, well, this is the popular technique.
Yeah, it's just the trend, isn't it?
Yeah, and I that's always a mistake to do something for that reason in any way.
Well, I guess too, because these three films that are nominated this year, unlike a lot of things that come in the past, come from also from filmmakers who really know what they want to say within the media. I mean, nobody is more of a real filmmaker. There aren't few than Miyazaki who suffers.
No, I mean, and that's great. I mean, that really, really is. You know, so when all that talk happens of like, oh, it's all just going to be computer. I mean, there's still a nice ray of hope when you see this happen.
I guess one of the things I like about the stop motion stuff that you do is there's always that look of shock that the characters get. I mean, you're talking about the eyes and the fox and the hound. Just think about how big people's eyes tend to get in these things that you do.
Yeah, well, you know, eye-popping experiences, you know, we always like to see those.
But that's a signature. I mean, going to the big films, you don't stop motion. Going back to Pee-wee's Big Adventure, somebody's eyes are popping out. It's almost like a combination of stop motion and Tex Avery.
Well, although I did have trouble when we were doing Nightmare, trying to convince him to do an animated character that has no eyes, you know. So, I mean, I'm moving up on the ladder, but that was quite an interesting, you know, to try to convince him you're going to do an appealing character, but he had no eyeballs. So that doesn't get much tougher than that, really.
I guess it doesn't get much tougher too, because in both Nightmare and in Corpse Bride, you know, you're dealing with a lot of, well, dead people.
Yeah, but I mean, again, for me, that's what I love about fairy tales. It's not. The great thing about that form is that you don't have to be literal. You know, that's why I'm saying, to me, it's less about life and death than it is about, like I was saying, the two sides of life, the sort of repressed versus the more open and artistic. So that's the great thing about that. It's all symbolic, and that's why it's kind of a fun medium, because you can kind of lay in things and ideas and things without having to be so overly literal about them.
You're talking to director Tim Burton. It's The Treatment. Another thing that runs your movies too, even the ones that are both originals and the adaptations and the live action and stop motion stuff, is that there's a real sort of look at the sort of social stratum about, you know, rich people versus poor people, or you know, the gentry of Corpse Bride, you know, versus the people who aren't restricted by those rules, and that's not something that comes out of Harry Allison at all. I mean, that comes out of
again, I think, growing up where people, I felt in sort of the suburban America I grew up in, it was you go to school and you were categorized. You were good in sports, or you're good in math, or you're not good, or you're weird, you know, and you'd see that really strong form of class or categorization about people. And I remember it from taking note of it very early on in my life. And I just never forgot it. I never stopped seeing it happen. You know, you see it then happen as you get older and all forms of society and life. And it always seems to kind of cut out something, you know, it cuts out people really connecting with each other or seeing things from another perspective, or, you know, I mean, that's why I like traveling and visiting other cultures, to see, you know, that there are other things and other ways of thinking. And I think people forget those things and get very rigid about things.
But it almost seems like in the movies you're doing, you're kind of rejecting it. Even those Disney movies, they were very much too about class, but also about rejecting things that didn't fall into a certain kind of social stratum. And it seems like a lot of the movies that you've done have been a real sort of rejection of the things that movies told us about class and about social standing and that stuff.
Yeah, because I always feel like there was another side to it. And like I said, what the side is presented as normal or I never found that to be the case. So I've always felt more connected to the people that were outcast from society or other people that didn't fit into a specific category. I mean, I think that's why I like being in England, because weirdly, it's got a class system, but at the same time, there seems to be a slightly more acceptance of people's eccentricities. And I'm not, you know, I always try to analyze why, and I'm not quite sure, but there's something about that I think made me feel more comfortable and more at home than I do in other sort of circumstances.
But there's that thing of, you know, there's almost always somebody in a waistcoat in one of your movies. I mean, be the stop motion stuff or the live action. Somebody's buttoned all the way up in a vest and almost sort of tied up. The suits are almost like straitjackets for people.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, I have a picture at home that I'll never forget, me in high school, and me in a brown leisure suit. So, and I could still feel that polyester. And so that kind of just straitjacket quality, I can still feel it scraping against my skin. Yeah.
That gives us a textural setting now for your movies that I think we'll never forget as an audience.
Yeah, let's try to get it out of your mind.
But I'm just fascinated by this because people often ask you about the way you make these movies real. Almost every single one of them is a social commentary. And in the most sort of fantastical and odd of settings, they're still sort of like basically telling people not to judge based on appearance.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, like I said, you know, most kids, I was completely sad because that's exactly the way I felt. I felt like, you know, I didn't seem to have, you know, make much contact with people, although I felt very like a friendly person. I felt like I was not a bad person, you know, a nice person. And yet I never seemed to be able to connect with people. So you get this sort of, again, somebody puts a category like, oh, you like monster movies and you don't speak much. You must be weird. And it's like, well, that's cutting out a whole person, you know, and by just laying a category on somebody, you're not really getting at anything, and you're not sort of living a life or seeing things or looking at things. And, you know, I think this is, again, it's important for anybody to do that.
But even the smallest of circumstances, even something like Stain Boy, that's very much still about that same thing about judging. And you give a superpower to this person with the oddest of sort of like fantastical attributes.
Is it a power or curse to stain like that? I don't know. with any superhero.
Tell the audience what Stain Boy is exactly. Because I mean, it's pretty
well,
wonderful.
It's just a superhero that doesn't really do anything. His only power is that he's able to leave a nasty stain wherever he goes. So, you know, it's not the most exciting action hero ever created, but for those of you that can't take too much excitement, he's pretty good.
Kind of an inaction hero,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly.
Are those going to be collected, by the way? No, you got to collect those shorts, the Stain Boy shorts.
Oh, I mean, I've got them around. I actually wouldn't mind doing it
for the rest of us.
I wouldn't mind doing it in certain kind of stop motion action, because I think that characters, they wouldn't move much, but it'd be nice dimensional, I think.
But if you would put those, I just wonder if there's ever any thought to doing that, because they're kind of hard to find.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, they're out there somewhere in the, you know, on the internet somewhere. I'm not sure where. Go on very much.
Then did you just sort of create them as a way to just sort of do something while you wait to get to the next bigger thing?
Yeah, and just fool around, you know. That's what I did, that little book. I always try to do something and little stories in between things just to kind of keep moving, yeah.
Well, I guess you are. And your next movie is?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I might be doing the story of Robert Ripley, the guy who created Ripley's Believe It or Not. So, you know, hopefully I think that might be it.
Well, I guess that's it for us. We're out of time. Tim, thanks so much for being here.
Nice to see you.
Guest is Tim Burton. Of course, this Oscar-nominated animated film is Corpse Bride, and last year he also had Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Our technical director in Los Angeles is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Lasha Wojcik at Carnegie Recording Studios in New York. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holdridge produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Treatment. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Business, a look deep inside the business of entertainment with Hollywood's top dealmakers, filmmakers, moguls, artists, and agents. Hosted by Claude Brodesser. Check out the podcast of The Business at kcrw.com.